Well, this is a special Tuesday trip back to the bygone days because our friend Dutch Thompson is here with stories from the bygone days. And we're comparing life in the city versus life growing up on a farm. Stories about a wicked teacher, the telephone party line, and an inspiring story about three island women who fought for the right to attend PEI's all-boys university, St. Dunstan's. Hello, Dutch.
Hey, Matthew. You know, it took me forever, but finally today, voices from two people born over 100 years ago who we've never had on the show before.
All right.
John Traynor, born in 1915 in Dona. He grew up in nearby Johnson's River. And Mary Hogan Nantes. Now, you might remember her daughter, Claire Nantes.
Claire Nantes was a great colleague of ours here at CBC, yeah.
Now, Mary was born in 1920, and both she and John lived through the Great Depression. Mary was a teenager. She had a friend who graduated from high school but was having a hard time landing a job in the 1930s.
She went to Prince Wales, and she was a good student, led the class in typing that year, got the prize. When college finished in May, no jobs. So her father was a good friend of a man that ran an insurance company, and he asked him, could he have a job for his daughter? He said, I couldn't hire anyone. I haven't got any money. So the father asked them, would he hire her just to keep her office skills up and her typing? He said, well, if she wants to come in those conditions, that's fine. So she worked for nothing.
Not even room and board?
Well, no, she lived at home, and she went downtown every day to where the office was. And then the next year, she had her name in for civil service. And then she went to Ottawa, worked up there.
But she worked for a year for free?
For free. And when she got married in 1942, she just thought because she worked up there, she'd come home here and get a job here. And women weren't hired for those jobs while they still had men available. But later on, when the men were gone overseas, they started to hire the women then.
Even as late as the 1940s, women were discriminated against.
Yeah. Oh, my father would say to someone, he'd say, can't that guy keep her? Much as to say, does she have to work? Yeah, like a stigma if you work, in a sense.
And absolutely, those attitudes didn't end back in those times, Dutch, but it was certainly more blatant, right?
Yeah, it was. And even when I was a kid in the 1950s, it was unusual to see any of the mothers on the street I lived on working. Now, we're going to hear another school story from Mary later, but let's first hear from John Traynor. Now, John's ancestry, as I mentioned, is 100% Irish. He grew up in the Fort Augustus, Dona, Johnson's River area, settled by the Monaghan Irish back in the 1830s. John had three brothers and three sisters. They all had chores on the farm. John's jobs mainly was with horses. He plowed with horses at a very young age. He told me his dad, Will, never owned a tractor. By 1929, John was out of school and looking for a paying job. And that's when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression swept across North America.
So you were raised on the farm. It was a farm.
Yeah, I grew up on the farm, yeah. And I always said I was born 15 years too soon. I was born 1915, and 1930, I was old enough to start to work. That's the year the Depression started.
Right.
And I say, there was 10 years lost there, you might say, in my life, because you couldn't make any money.
No.
There was no work. But the thing about the Depression, nobody had much of anything. You know, your neighbor didn't have a bigger car than you, he didn't have any. Things like that, you know, everybody was about the same. It was nice that way, you know. Now, if somebody, neighbor, gets a big car, well, the other neighbor, I should have won like that too, you know. That's the way they are now, I think.
And I suppose people helped each other out more too, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nobody would see anybody stuck, you know, if there was something that they needed bad or whatever. If somebody died, you know, and the neighbors be all around, helped to dug the grave at that time, you know, for them and that, all things like that, you know. My oldest brother's wife died when she was, I think, about 34 or 5. Every night, I don't know whether you'd believe this story or not, but every night some of the neighbors had to go, would go, you know, and keep him company and keep her company. So this night it happened to be my turn and a neighbor woman, Mr. McCauley. So we were there. Miss McCauley was in the room with bedroom, and Fred had laid down. He fell asleep on the couch, and I was in the kitchen. I heard this knock at the door, so I went to the door and opened the door, but nobody couldn't see anybody. So I went back and I sat down, and the knock came again. And Miss McCauley's in the room. She said to me, "Did you not hear the knock at the door, John?" This was the second knock, so I went, "Nobody there." So I got the horses, and some of the cattle were out around, and I thought, well, maybe the horse, you know, hit banging or something. I went out and I walked all around the yard and the barn. I couldn't see a thing. She died in an hour, and I always said that's the forerunner. You see, these three knocks. Yeah, she died within the hour. I heard the forerunners, I heard the old people talking, but I believed that that was one, you know.
And that was your first experience with one?
That was the first, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That was John Traynor's first encounter with a forerunner, and that's when his sister-in-law, Evelyn Traynor, died so tragically young at the age of 34.
Those forerunner stories are always so compelling, Dutch. Yeah.
Well, when you live through one, I guess you believe after that, don't you?
You've certainly heard a lot of those stories through the years. And John, we were talking about in 1939, the Second World War began, which more or less ended the Great Depression. But John was talking about 10 lost years there. Did he serve? Was he a veteran?
Yes, he was. He spent almost 5 years in the Canadian Army, perhaps not exactly the paying job he had been looking for back in 1929. All right, let's back up a bit and compare John and Mary's experiences at school. Now, Mary lived in the east end of Charlottetown. Her dad, William, a railway man, had one of only two cars on Dorchester Street. She skated at the nearby forum along with her 10 brothers and sisters. She was fourth from the bottom, by the way. Her older siblings attended St. Joseph's School, but Mary started out her schooling at the Notre Dame Convent just up the street.
One of the reasons why I went to the convent, I was like smaller and delicate too than older ones. They could walk to St. Joseph's. So I went to grade 9, and I did the rest of it at St. Joseph's.
So you could do like your high school at St. Joseph's?
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out if everybody went to PWC.
No, everybody didn't, but there was two or three girls in town that couldn't afford. They wanted to go on to university. So they went to the bishop, who was more or less, I guess, the head person for the university, because it started by the priests. It was a Catholic university, and they wanted to go there. No girls had ever attended there. So they just said, "Why can't we?" She was definite and wanted an answer. Three of them went. But this Butler girl, John Butler's sister, was the spokesperson, and she wanted an answer. So I guess they had a meeting and said, "Well, yeah, why can't they go?" And they were the first group of girls that went to St. Dunstan's. Then it was a co-ed college, more or less. Be in the 30s.
In the 30s. And they were the first ones. They were friends of yours.
Well, I knew them well. And then later years, John Butler lived next door to me. He was the city comptroller. Yeah, that was his sister. She and two other girls. Yeah, good for them. Only for them. It was still boys' college.
Mary witnessing a seismic change there, Dutch.
Really?
A welcome change.
Yeah, exactly. And I might mention St. Joseph's School might be better known as the Rochford Square School.
Right.
A lot of people went there and knew it as that rather than St. Joseph's. It was on Pownall Street and was more or less an offshoot of the Notre Dame Academy. And grades 1 to 11 were taught there, and the nuns taught in both schools. And I think it closed around 1975. But at its peak, believe it or not, it had 700 students
Whoa.
Attending St. Joseph's, yeah. On the other hand, John attended a one-room school in Johnson's River, 30 students, one teacher trying to maintain some semblance of order. Now, if you go back 100 years ago, students in the country started in August so that they could go potato picking later nice. In the fall to earn some hard-to-come-by cash.
We got a dollar a day.
And it'd be a nice short 8-hour day, wasn't it?
Yes. It's mostly till pretty near dark in the evening, remember that. You got your two meals out of them.
Oh, you did as well.
Dinner and supper, yeah. Oh, it was good, too. You could make probably $10 or $15 anyway to buy your winter clothes with at that time. It was very good.
Yeah. And would you start school early in the summer? Would you start in August?
Yeah, I'd start on my birthday.
And around the 14th.
Yeah. Yeah, 2 weeks off in the fall. That was vacation.
Some vacation.
There wasn't much vacations at that time.
How did you like school?
It depended on the teacher. We had some nice teachers and we had a couple of hellers too. The one I remember the worst about was that she was from town and she didn't know anything about country, you know, or country people. And along with that, she was ignorant. But she had this rod, you know, this is a wooden rod. You'd get that over the hands, the big wooden rod, when you did something. So one evening, me and another fellow thought, let's cut that rod. You see, the school was never locked. So we went in and we cut a big slit in the rod, you know, not enough for it to fall apart. And the first fellow she walloped, it fell on the floor and whacked him.
It broke.
Broke right off, yeah. Well, that's sort of why we had it figured, you see. Oh, God, she was wicked. I'm going to find out who cut that rod before you kids go home. Nobody would tell, you know. A lot of them knew we did it, but nobody tell. Is there staying in school till I find out? She didn't find out because nobody would tell. At last, she had to let us go. But then the next thing she got was a strap. No more wood. She used to go to town sometimes. She lived in town on the weekend. She landed back to stay with a strap. I guess we didn't know what to do with the strap, but me and a couple other lads, we did something. But anyway, she kept us in after school. But he gave us the strap. So hold out your hands, you know, and you got a good walloping with the strap. And well, there was three of us, and this Harold Curry, he shoved the hands in the desk when she came to him. She whacked him over the face with the strap. You know, if that was today, she'd be in court. Yeah, she gave it to him over the face.
It's funny his parents didn't come up looking for blood.
Well, at that time, you know, the parents mostly went along with the teacher. If you got a licking in school and some of the parents heard what you did, you got another one home.
You know, that is shocking to hear that. There's no question there would be legal proceedings today on that, though.
Oh, absolutely.
My goodness.
But, you know, the good thing is that mean teacher didn't last too long. She was replaced by a McDonald woman from Glenfinnan, who, as John said, knew the ways of the country folk. John loved that new teacher, by the way, which was a good thing because she boarded at the trainer house.
It would have been awkward had he not, yeah.
With 11 kids, whatever it was,
oh
at home.
Gosh.
I can't imagine where she slept. But anyway, we won't go into that. Now, John finished grade 9. He went on to work sporadically, as we heard earlier, in 1929 at the age of 15. All right, time for two more stories from the city mouse and the country mouse. These ones might be a little bit more upbeat.
You're good.
Now, if you lived in the country and had the luxury of a telephone, you knew all about the entertainment the telephone party line provided. People along the road shared a common phone line, and listening in to other people's conversations was a finely honed art. You had to be careful not to breathe or make any noises that might alert the two people having a private, or so they thought, conversation.
And, of course, you fellas were out there. You had no electricity.
No.
Was there a telephone? Did you have a phone?
We had, yeah, what they called the party line. There'd be probably 25 or 30 on the line. Some of them would be listening, you know. I remember our ring was 1-5, one long and 5 short. Would say it'd ring, and some of the more nosy ones, they'd take the receiver down and listen, you know. And this went on. This is a good one, this old fellow. I guess he lived alone. His last name was Rooney, and it might have been Ned. But he'd always listening. People knew he was listening. So these two fellows got together one day, and the one fellow called the other, and they got talking, and they had this made up. And this fellow told the other fellow some story, you know, and the other fellow said, I don't think that's so, he said. I don't. Who told you that? Ned Rooney. And Ned was, I did not. So I don't know whether he listened, kept on listening after that or not.
They trapped him, though.
Trapped him, yeah.
Definitely entrapment. I love how they drew Ned out of the shadows there.
He couldn't help himself. And he mentioned Letty McKinnon. Now, she was a midwife, and she ran a maternity home in her own house in Crossroads, and she was also the central telephone operator for something like 43 years.
Wow.
Absolutely astounding woman. All the calls in the local area, all the way to Pownall, all the way to China Point, went through her, and she told John the hardest connections that she had to make were during the Second World War because people were getting news of a loved one's death overseas.
Sure.
she'd be the first one to hear. Now, people like me assume life in the city was easier than on a farm because, well, when you heat a farmhouse, it meant you had to go to the woods to hack down some firewood, then block it, and then split it. In the city, on the other hand, coal was king. Mm. Now, when Mary Nantes was growing up in the 1930s, even coal was something you might find in your Christmas stocking.
The first couple of houses we lived in, they didn't have bathtubs. They might have a small room with a sink in it, with the big bowl and the great big jug. And people would pour water and didn't have a sponge bath. Now they have to have two or three showers a day. You weren't well off, but you weren't poor. But yeah, there were some people in the east end of the town used to go down and take a bucket with them and get the coal that would fall off the railroad carts because they'd be open. And there was one person, she was a woman, she'd go up to there was a ladder on the side, throw coal off the big boxcars that were open top, and then there'd be all kinds of coal around the ground. But most people got coal delivered in the fall, shoot into a basement window, and the basement would be full of coal. Imagine how dust and dirty it was.
Yeah. What was it like at Christmas with all those kids?
Well, you didn't get a lot, but everybody would get something. Mm-hmm. So.
And would you write a letter to Santa? Do you remember doing that?
Oh, yeah. We'd lift up the cover of the stove and put it in the stove. We burned it. It was supposed to be going up the chimney. Your childish thinking that it was going up the chimney. That's what people would do. Yeah. Oh, yeah, write one letter after another. I remember as a grown up, saying to my grandchildren one time, they had all kinds of stuff, and we were all together at one of the daughter's houses. And I guess at one time I had said, you know, I never ever had a teddy bear in my life. So this evening after dinner, the three of them were in front of me, I guess they were 12, 14, 15, and said, Nanny, we have a gift for you. And I opened a gift, and it was a beautiful teddy bear. And they said, we heard you say one time you never had a teddy bear, so now you have a teddy bear.
Wasn't that lovely?
Wasn't it sweet of them?
Oh, I love that story, Dutch.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Oh, really nice. She told me that she loved poring over the Eaton's catalog, and when her older brother John landed a job, she would leave the catalog with the page open to the toys and the presents that she wanted from Santa Claus on his bedside table. And she said John was a very kind-hearted man, and she and her little brothers and sisters were well looked after by him and by Santa.
We're going to post photos to go along with today's stories online on Dutch's Facebook page. You can always hear Dutch's stories again by tracking down the Main Street page through our website, cbc.ca/PEI. And Dutch, we ended there with a nice story from Mary about sharing and giving in the holiday season. And I think you have more stories along that theme for us on Thursday, right?
On Thursday, I'm going to bring in three stories about sharing, and we're going to give away a couple more birdhouses to folks. We're going to share the bird wealth.
Yes, these are the birdhouses you've made out of recycled materials, right?
That's right.
We'll give a couple of those away. This is our live broadcast from Founders Food Hall and Market, a special edition of Main Street this Thursday as part of our Make the Season Kind campaign. Dutch will be there to share stories along with comedian Patrick Ledwell. Great music from Craig Fair and Lawrence Maxwell and Brooke MacArthur. Claire Rankin, who plays Mary Critch on Son of a Critch, will be joining us. Lots of special guests and giveaways. We'll have the hot chocolate on. And would love to see you there on Thursday. Appreciate you joining us on Thursday, Dutch. That'll be fun.
Looking forward to it.
This is all part of Make the Season Kind. We do have drop-off locations for food donations across the province, as well a spot where you can make online monetary donations through our website, cbc.ca/kindPEI.